Hi there, folks, and welcome or welcome back to Nippon Trading International's Japan Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Ziv Nakajimam again, and this podcast is brought to you, among others, by Emil Gorgis of realestate.jp. He's a Tokyo real estate agent who specializes in serving international or mixed nationality families who are looking for the perfect family home. So Emil's an Australian. He's been living here in Japan for over two decades now. And for about half of that time, he's been buying, selling, and managing real estate properties in Tokyo on behalf of his own family and a great many happy clients. And he also acts as a mortgage broker on behalf of his clients. So he's got dedicated loan officers in many of the Japanese mega banks. And if you're a regular listener of the podcast, you probably already know him from our JREP, the Japan Real Estate Experts panel sessions, which means that you're already aware of the fact that the man is an absolute fountain of wisdom on all things related to real estate in Japan, and in particular to family homes, the greater Tokyo metropolitan area, and mortgages. And most importantly, he's incredibly generous with his time and advice, which he's more than happy to provide at no cost or commitment to anyone asking. So if you've been thinking about buying your home in Tokyo, but you've been sitting on the fence for a while, or you just want to have a chat in English with a real expert, drop him a line on sales@realestate.jp. Hit him up today and start exploring your options. All right, special episode lined up for you all today, folks, and one that's always a lot of fun to put together every year. But before we go there, quick few updates on the spring session of the Japan Real Estate Summit, which is coming up in a bit less than 2 months' time in Tokyo. We've now confirmed two more exciting speakers for the event. The first is Alicia Wang from Axolotl Capital, our investment loan specialist, who will be sharing some exciting information about loans for both residents and non-residents, which can be applied for and received even without being physically present in Japan. Alicia had her debut at our last summit and was a big success. That was news to me personally, that you can actually get those loans without being here, and very exciting news at that. Also, a brand new speaker, and one that many of you are probably already familiar with, Shu Matsuo and his business partner Brent Lee, who are doing some very exciting work with the purchase, renovation, and profiting from these older homes and akiyas that we keep talking about here in Japan. And they've got some exciting new projects and services that they'll be unveiling and explaining. Both of these speakers, as well as everybody else who's already on the roster, the JREP crew that you're all probably already familiar with, Shimizu-san, our immigration and corporation lawyer, Matthew Kyle, our back office and global expansion expert, Chai Kanda, our Kyoto and Osaka expert, all of these speakers, and myself, of course, we're all going to be also available throughout the weekend, or at least throughout most of it, to chat, do some case studies and deals analysis and the breakout room sessions, answer your questions, etc. So if you still haven't pre-registered for your discounted tickets and you know that you can be in Tokyo during this weekend, 12 and 13 April, Saturday, Sunday, or would be available on those dates to join us via the stream, I wouldn't wait. So hop over to our website at nippontradings.com. That's N-I-P-P-O-N, Nippon Tradings with an S, all one word, .com. Tracy, who's in charge of ticketing, is literally putting together the full price ticketing page as we speak. So those discounted tickets won't be around for much longer. Go grab yours today. And this is also an excellent chance to express our gratitude for all of our sponsors, old and a whole bunch of new ones who are joining us this year, helping us to continue and provide this awesome event at low prices, while at the same time making it longer, better, and full of even more and more content and value for you. Those sponsors are realestate.jp, your home for Tokyo family homes, specializing in servicing foreign and mixed nationality couples, innovatious.com, your one-stop shop for all things related to your digital footprint, website design, social media management, Shiki Properties, your Kyoto and Osaka real estate and hospitality specialist, Kaku Accounting Firm, the best, hands down, we use them, best bilingual bookkeeping and accounting professionals out there, and Axolotl Capital, who are one of the only sources for property investment loans in Japan for non-residents, as we've mentioned, but they can, of course, help you get one of those yummy mortgages if you're a resident as well. So huge thank you to all of our sponsors. You make it all possible, and we appreciate you to no end. Okay, so as I've mentioned at the start, today's one of our special annual episodes. And this time around, it's the highlights reel, if you will, clips and segments from your favorite podcast episodes of the Japan Real Estate Podcast in the last 12 months. So from February 2024 to February 2025, these are the top 10 episodes and YouTube videos that you've downloaded or streamed more than any other this last year. And as always, they cover a wide variety of topics, which just goes to show what a diverse and interesting crowd you all are. It's always fascinating to me to see what parts of our content holds the most interest for our listeners and subscribers, and this year was no different. So here they are in ascending order from the 10th most popular episode to the most popular one. And we'll link to each of those in the episode show notes as well, of course. So feel free to go back and listen to any of the full ones if you've missed them or you just want a refresher on what we were talking about that time. So here we go. Starting from number 10 in your list of favorites this year. This was an interview with Kurt, originally from the US and married to a Japanese spouse. She's originally from Shizuoka, and he was asking what's the best approach to potentially convince an absentee Japanese property owner, someone who hasn't listed their property and apparently has no interest in selling it, to do so. Here's a clip of our conversation.
Well, I think you've given me some great ideas here. I think what I'm reading, if I can just kind of say it back to it, is be tactful, try to find a way to at least get an offer in front of him so that he's aware that there's an interested party. And if possible, I should stay out of the picture, being the foreigner.
Absolutely.
I should stay out of the picture and let my wife, who's a local, knows the family and knows the local ways, let her lead the charge, which I'm not.
Yeah, and I wouldn't even mention, like, in her letter or offer, I wouldn't even mention that she's lived in the States and coming back to Japan. Just mention that, you know, she and her family are from the area and she is interested in purchasing the house. That's it. I wouldn't add anything beyond that.
Very good.
Yeah.
I like that. Yeah, right. So just keep the foreign element out if at all possible, right?
Correct. Yeah. I mean, by the time there's a signing of the contract and a deposit payment in front of him, then even obviously he might see your name on the contract then, but it's rare that somebody will say no to the deposit and the sale when the money is right in front of them. Mm-hmm. But having said that, Japan has its own unique type of mental health issues. He could be a hikikomori who just doesn't answer the door, doesn't read letters at all, and will not respond. I mean, I'm not saying slim chances, but I'd say there's a 50-50% chance that might not even work in far before we get to the contract signing part. Very interesting conversation with Kurt there, including his own personal story, which wasn't included in this short clip. I highly recommend to go back and listen to it. A lot of fun. Now, in ninth place, this is a conversation with Nick Woolsey, a good friend of the podcast and a semi-regular guest as well. Nick is founder and CEO of Japan Remotely. He's also spoken at our last summit in Tokyo back in October 2024. And his company specializes in helping people map and flesh out their plan to relocate to Japan. We often talk here on the podcast with him about stuff related to his line of work, the digital nomad visa, finding housing in Japan, working here, etc. And on this occasion, the topic was, should people who are moving here buy their residence before, during, or after their move, before or after acquiring their residency visa and so forth? So really a matter of timing. If and when you're moving to Japan, when exactly should you start looking at potential properties for purchase? Here's a snip from our chat.
I've been thinking about when is the best, how does it work, and when is the best timing to buy one of these houses, is especially if you're considering relocating to Japan. I can think to myself, on the one hand, if you're going to relocate to Japan, getting there first and working with somebody like Nippon Tradings to go together and visit these properties is one way to do it. And once you have your house and you have you know, enough time to look at it, going ahead and moving in. But on the other hand, it could be better to have the house in place before you get there. It could be easier. So could you tell me a little bit about the timeline and the basics of buying a property in Japan? How long should someone take from start to finish to buy a house in Japan?
Well, the short answer is obviously it depends, right? We have clients of different profiles, and the two paths that you've described suit specific people at specific points in their lives. The prime criteria I'd say would be, what are your living arrangements while you're in Japan and still don't have a house? Are you okay? Do you have the budget? Do you have the capacity? Do you have the connections to stay somewhere cheaply, or at least in a way that's not going to be devastating to your budget? Because if you're going to be in a hotel room for 3 months, that's obviously going to cost, right? Even an Airbnb, it's depending on the size of the size of the group you're in. And I mean, I'd say if it's a single or a couple, it may be a bit more feasible. But if you're a family with kids, keeping five or six people somewhere for 3 months while you're looking for a house can be a bit of a nightmare, both financially and logistically. So that's one aspect of it. Remote viewings are obviously not 100% substitute for in-person viewings, but I'd say the vast majority of our clients would prefer us to do remote viewings on their behalf, especially if it's holiday homes or homes that they're going to be using for, let's say, up to 6 months a year, and it's not their primary residence. The more it becomes your primary residence, the more I'd say it would be beneficial for you to come and view in person before pulling a trigger on a deal. Unless it's a brand new built home, but then we're not talking about the 100,000 and below anymore, right?
Yeah, that's a more substantial investment for sure.
The process takes, let's assume that you're not extremely picky. And you're not that constrained on budget. So rather than say 100 and 100,000 and or under, I would maybe be more comfortable saying 100 to 150, because that would,
That would be move-in ready.
yes, in most cases they'll be move-in ready, unless you're, right in the center of Tokyo or Osaka, obviously a bit more challenging. But in other places, yes, that would be move-in ready, even if not brand new. And then that would take less time to source, unless you're again very picky, because some people are very laser focused on traditional aspects of Japanese architecture, or certain size of garden or backyard, or certain distance from particular facilities that just maybe not that common, right? In a particular budget, at least. So, assuming you're not too picky and the budget is not too constrained, it would normally take a month or two to source your final shortlist, potentially less than that, but let's call it up to a month or two. And then a month or two from when an offer is accepted, depending on whether you need to or don't need a structural inspection, which we would advise for properties that are 30 years and older. So without the structural inspection and waiting for that report, I'd say a month to signing the contract. With the inspection, maybe up to 2 months to signing the contract, and then another month for documentation and settlement. So you'd need to execute a couple of documents overseas, get the hard copies couriered back here to Japan, at which point the settlement can take place. So worst case scenario, from the moment an offer is accepted, I'd say about 3 months.
Okay. That's interesting because that's similar to the amount of time that processing a long-term visa takes.
Good point.
It might be beneficial for people to think of it as one process. They've decided to move to Japan, they've decided to buy a house, and it's a lot of work, but maybe they should do those activities in parallel. Get with their immigration lawyer and their real estate facilitator at the same time and kicking off those processes, because it does take the better part of 3 months to do it.
Well, I mean,
I
that's
so
assuming that you have a fair likelihood of the visa being approved. Otherwise, you're going to end up
yeah.
with maybe a holiday home instead of a residential home, and then would you have paid that much?
Yeah, that's true. There's some risk involved with that strategy. So in that case, if you're risk averse, it might be better to wait for your visa to go through and be 100%, and then look for the house once you're in Japan. I guess it depends on your risk profile and what it
Unless
is
you're
you're trying
sure
to
that you're
do.
definitely, unless you're sure that you're definitely be going to be coming here for at least a month or two a year, and will have some use of the property regardless, right?
All right, so on to eighth place now. And this was a conversation with a client who was wondering about their options to obtain financing for an investment property here. We discussed all sorts of topics related to the purchase, the loans, the incorporation here in Japan. And this part of the conversation is specifically on the topic of opening a local bank account here for non-resident investors.
when I spoke with immigration lawyer Hiroshi Shimizu a couple of days ago, and talking about business setup, and I don't know if I heard this on your podcast or if I'm getting it mixed up, but one of the things he said to do was to that it's impossible to get a corporate bank account if you don't already have a individual bank account in Japan.
That's that probably not on the podcast, but that's quite correct. Yes.
And so
if you're the sole owner of the business, yes. But again, if you've got a company with a Japanese resident, long-term resident, or permanent resident or national as your executive director, representative director, then that becomes a bit easy. But I mean, yeah, I guess it's the same thing because they'll be looking at his individual history, right? And he would have a personal bank account, he, she. So kind of, but there are, I mean, it takes a lot of, I've got another company that helps people with that kind of thing. It takes a lot of trial and error and hits and misses. And it is possible, essentially. With the online banks, it is becoming a little bit easier. They're a lot less strict than the traditional brick and mortar Japanese banks. But easy, it's definitely not.
Yeah. And that was his solution was, you know, SBI, Shinsei, or that, which is an online bank, and he named a few others, but
Shinsei is not an, I don't think Shinsei is an online bank. SBI, Sony Bank, PayPay Bank, GMO, Aozora, Shumi. There's one that our other company has an account with. I forget the name. Sumishin? Sumishin, also an online bank. There's a bunch of them, and they're a bit more lenient than traditional Japanese banks, but still easy. It's never easy. Even for Japanese residents, if they're opening a new company and they don't have a track record as anything except a salaryman individual, even for Japanese nationals, it's difficult. It's challenging. Yeah. But again, online banks are a lot easier.
Yeah. Okay. I'm trying to figure out the whole landscape of opening a business, and it seems like there's so many hoops to jump through.
Well, setting up the company itself is really easy. Shimizu-san can do that for you within a month, but everything else, office lease, bank account, any kind of relationships with Japanese business partners, that's all a bit challenging for foreigners, and even more so for non-resident foreigners. Yeah. I hope we'll get there someday, but Japan takes a long time to change. Now, here's some big news for anyone interested in Akiya, the abandoned vacant homes that are abundant all around Japan for very attractive purchase prices. Akiya Mart, our latest sponsor, is a recently founded online search and discovery tool for Japanese real estate. Its user interface will be very familiar to users of Zillow or Redfin. The platform essentially scouts the internet for property listings, translates them into English, and displays prices in US dollars, all in one place and with a dynamic map interface that makes browsing, finding, and shortlisting your favorite properties a piece of cake. Which any of you have been struggling with the dozens, if not hundreds, of Japanese property websites that are available online and their very clunky interface will probably find a real blessing. They've got already over 500,000 listings on the platform, and the database is expanding daily. Ranging from abandoned rural homes to luxury urban properties, Akiya Mart makes it easy to find your dream home in Japan, regardless of your budget. Now, while the platform is essentially free for use, here's an exclusive offer for listeners of the podcast. You can use the promo code NTI to receive $5 off Akiya Mart Pro. The subscription will unlock a bunch of very attractive features for you, including unrestricted access to the entire nationwide property database and a whole range of filters, which will help power charge your search for that elusive perfect home and make it even easier. So hop over to akiya-mart.com. That's AKIYA-MART, akiya-mart.com, and kick off your search today. So, moving on, we're now at 7th place, and this is where a very popular topic first surfaced in these top 10. The topic of short-term stays, Minpaku Airbnb. We had a chat with this very lovely couple who are considering purchasing a property in Kyoto or Osaka for their own personal holiday use, but also want to rent it out when they're not using it, either via monthly rentals or short-term rentals. And so we talk about whether or not this plan qualifies as an investment, and if not, what would an actual real estate property investment look like in Japan? if you want to do short-term stay investment, then you have to be very hands-on, buy in a better location, beautifully renovate the place, have a management company that's constantly got their finger on the pulse and constantly looking for people to populate. What you're looking at is more of a, I'm assuming you're visiting like 2-3 months a year, not more than that, right?
Yeah, because we're going to kind of go in together with others in our family. So we're planning on going in with maybe 3 or 4 people. So it just depends, I suppose, when, we would just obviously slot in when there's free time, I suppose.
Definitely don't think about this as a profit driver or income driver or anything like that. It's more a case of, can I cover my property tax and the maintenance and repairs and maybe have a little bit left over if I'm lucky kind of thing?
What budget will we be looking at for like investment more so?
Well, if you're really looking for an investment, I would advise to not think about it as the place you'll be holidaying in, because then you want to maximize profits. And, you know, if it happens to be occupied when you want to use it, then, you know, use that money for accommodation yourselves rather than hamper the population, the populating of the property. So, I don't know. I mean, depends on how hands-on you want to be. If you are okay constantly working with the property manager to tweak the price that you're asking for, checking vacancy rates, occupancy rates, what the competition is doing, what kind of features catering to a specific niche market of guests, then it can be profitable. But that's not a full-time job, but it's very hands-on. The other option, if you want a strictly investment, like semi-passive investment property, then just buy something and lease it out long-term. The returns are lower, but I mean, probably purchase price would be lower as well. So you could get a few of those, maybe a couple of those for that same budget, and they'll make you something like 4-6% before tax. With short-term stays, you can, if it's run really, really well, like a smooth, well-oiled machine, then you could maybe potentially double that, but it's very hands-on.
Yeah, because we kind of didn't want to say if we did go down the Airbnb or like short-term stays, we didn't want to be like in on it. We just wanted like property managers and all that to look after it. So
they'll do it, but if you want to make sure your investment is done well, then you want to be proactive, because they're not always going to be, and you want to constantly poke them and see who they're catering to and how they're advertising and how much they're advertising it for a rent at. And it's not, if it's short-term stay, it's not going to be hands off. If it's monthly stay, potentially yes, because then somebody again will be renting it for like 4-8 months is the average usually at a time. And that's somewhere, I guess, in between, in the term of mental bandwidth that you need between short-term stay and just straight out long-term leasing. All right, on to 6th place in your list of favorite episodes of this year. Those were 2 back-to-back conversations with potential buyers. We're only showing one of them here, both of which are targeting the lower end of the market. So we chat about what buying super cheap actually means, who it may or may not be suitable for, and what they should be watching out for when they're digging around that bottom end of the market here.
So I was looking at a budget of $70,000, and I figured I would get a place that's relatively nice off, not a lot of refurbishing necessary to begin with. But then I figured I kind of want to use my hands. I want to work. So I lowered the budget. I found some places that looked decent. I figured I could try to make $5 million stretch out a bit. Additionally, the $7 million was pushing a loan budget that I was hoping for that I probably couldn't get in the end. So this is somewhere where I wanted to start, see what is available, and try to make work. I mean, obviously, saving a little bit of money is always nice.
Yeah, well, but 70,000 US is not really 7 million yen at the moment. It's more like, what is it? It's more like 10.2 million yen.
Yep.
So 5 million yen will usually, depending on location, but usually will buy you a house that's not in good condition. But the issue is not what you can DIY or not. The issue is whether it's going to have structural problems that is not something that you'd be able to DIY.
Right.
So tilting, sinking, floors, termite tracks, roof water leak issues. These are all items that I'm assuming would be a lot more challenging to DIY fix, right? Some of them are just not worth fixing. It might be a better idea to rebuild the property if those issues occur. So, I mean, we could find diamonds in the rough, but in most cases, if you're buying anything this cheap, you'd probably, let's say anything that you buy that's older than 30 years old, you probably want to do a structural inspection in any case before signing anything.
Sure.
And the structural inspections, each of those costs somewhere between 100 to 150,000 yen. So let's call it 1,000 US or a bit less. If you look at very cheap houses, you're going to find that many of them will fall through during the structural inspection. So it's a question of how many of those inspections do you actually want to pay for? Because that'll eat into your budget significantly if you're looking at 10 properties and each of them falls through, right?
Right.
Okay, so this is where things start getting hotter. We're up to our final five top-ranked and most downloaded/streamed episodes of the last 12 months. And at number five, it's our first and only JREP, Japan Real Estate Experts Panel session on this top list. The topic is home loan mortgages here in Japan, who can or cannot qualify for those, and how non-permanent residents may be able to apply. Naturally, Emil Gorgis from realestate.jp was the one who did most of the talking on this topic, as is usually the case. Here's some of what he had to say about it.
Buying a house in terms of cash contribution is often cheaper than renting a property. Because when you rent, you need about 6 months worth of rent cash to do that. However, if you don't have permanent residency and you don't have a Japanese spouse, then you're likely not eligible for that 100% financing. But you can still get 80% financing. So if you're not permanent resident, then the bank thinks, you're a little bit higher risk that you may just leave the country at any time. So if we give you 100% financing, that's a little bit risky. If you leave where you have no money invested in the property, so you can just leave and when we're stuck with it. So what they require is at least a 20% deposit. So if you don't have permanent residency, you can get 80% financing. You still need to pay 20% deposit plus the about 5% closing costs. So that's kind of the only thing that's different. Except they will care about your employment.
Not all banks would approve that, right?
Oh, correct. Yeah. I mean, it's not all banks allow that. There's maybe three banks at the top of mind that I think we'll do that. However, it also there's the simple approach, but depending on the type of employment that you have and your income. So for example, this particular inquiry, the person said they have around 4 million yen annual income. One of the banks that does that has a requirement of at least 5 million yen annual income, right? So you need to be over 5 million yen annual. Other banks will accept it as well, but they'll also have Japanese requirements. So in general, with Japanese banks, you need to be able to understand some Japanese and converse in Japanese. It doesn't have to be a very high level, and you don't need to be able to read the full contract in Japanese, but they want you to understand their explanation. Often when we deal with our banks, I will attend with the bank with you. And although I'm not meant to just translate or interpret, often, even if you have sort of, you know, some quite basic Japanese, that should be sufficient. If you try to go into a bank yourself and apply directly, you can still do that, but you're going to have to wing a lot of the Japanese ability, and maybe there's some stuff that's going over your head. And if the bank feels, this, we're not so confident with this person's understanding of the mortgage and the terms, then they'll say, look, you don't speak Japanese well enough to get the loan. But often if you're, you know, with us, I'll often explain a lot of the financing stuff in advance, and you'll have a good idea of how the system works. So when you go in and we're doing the discussion with the bank, you'll kind of already understand the concepts that they're presenting.
Now, if you've attended any of our recent JREP Summit events in Tokyo or online, you've probably heard our sponsor, Robert Miller from Innovatius.com. He's been in WebDiz Solutions here in Japan for the past 25 years, and he's also an active investor in Japanese real estate property, as well as global online property, which is his specialty and what his company Innovatius is all about. They offer a full suite of website services for entrepreneurs and small business owners, including all aspects of web design and management, backup and updates, content formatting and editing, proactive maintenance and error fixing, you name it, with a strong focus on SEO excellence, which is what gets you those hardcore top-of-the-list search engine rankings. But there is a difference. Innovatius works off a simple, all-inclusive monthly subscription model, as opposed to the typical outdated and confusing project model. So you never have to wonder how much any request for any work to be done on your website might cost. It's always $497 per month. And if that's not enough, if you've mentioned you've heard of their services on the Japan Real Estate Podcast, you'll also get 10% off this monthly price for life. Also, and equally important, if not more, you can try out Innovatius for just 1 month, then switch them off, on again later if you want, and so forth. There are no minimum subscription terms. Now, if you're a small business owner, managing and growing a website is super distracting and time-consuming, right? That's exactly where Innovatius comes in. Robert's team takes care of all of that for you so that you can focus on what you do best. So feel free to email Rob on robert@innovatius.com, and his team will conduct a full SEO and website audit on your site, reveal anything that you should address to increase your website's appeal, and provide you with an easy-to-read detailed report with your own branding so that you can make some informed decisions on your online strategy and watch your business grow as you implement it. So once more, robert@innovatius.com. Drop him a line and get your website reviewed today. Thank you, Emil. Insightful as always. And a quick reminder that Emil will be speaking at our upcoming summit in Tokyo on 12-13 April. If you've ever spoken to him or heard him speak, you know what a solid and knowledgeable dude he is. Don't miss your chance to hear him live, in person, or via the stream at the event and pick his brain. Tickets, again, are available on our website, nippontradings.com. So now, on to fourth place in our most popular episodes countdown on the Japan Real Estate Podcast. And this time, we're talking basic real estate property investment, real 101 stuff. And this is me advising a first-time buyer on what would be a good strategy for their first purchase here in the land of the rising sun. Here's a short clip from that conversation. Okay, so let's assume 125,000, and let's talk as if you're not taking a loan. Obviously, you'll have more options if you do, but let's assume you're not borrowing here. Then that opens up most of the market for you. We can get some older and smaller, but even some Tokyo units at that price. They wouldn't be super central, but they'd probably be in relatively good locations. And then the question becomes, I'm assuming you don't want to have another short-term stay property. We're talking long-term leases, right?
So I wouldn't mind, but from what I've heard, again, on your, I listen to your show a lot, man. Like, so I heard you talk about how something for Minpaku's, for short-term rentals, that it had to be on certain weekends, or it can't be on certain days or something like that, or next to schools.
Depends on the municipality. Each of them will have their own local regulation. So the national framework just says you can minpaku up to half the year. Okay. But you, and then the other half of the year, people usually make up for it with monthly rentals, which just falls under normal rental. But you could apply for a hotel license. It's not that big of a deal. And then you would be able to rent it out minpaku throughout the year. But what all of that means is that, number one, we'll have to buy more central properties, a little bit newer, preferably family sized. If it's within a condo, if it's within a kind of owner union condo situation, then you can only do monthly. You're not going to be able to do minpaku at all. So everything has to be rented out with a lease in place, even if it's a short-term lease. So it has to be for a period of 1 month or more, and with a rental lease in place. And the lease can just be a single page kind of lease, but it has to be a normal rental, not a short-term stay with check-ins and check-outs and so forth.
Okay. So and, the condo wouldn't be eligible for the hotel license, right?
Not for a Minpaku or hotel license, no, because the owner union would never allow it. And unless they specifically write in the owner rule book that they allow it, which 99% of them would never do, then yeah. You're not going to be able to. But monthly rentals are still an option if at least there's a monthly rentals capable company in the area that can service it, which again is a lot easier in the more central and bigger city the property's in. Mm-hmm. So that's an option with condo units. I mean, the owner unions still don't like it, but the monthly rental companies know how to work around them. Kind of, right. They hassle them instead of the tenants, and they're fine with that. So that's an option for actual Minpaku or hotel license. You will need to own the entire structure.
Yeah,
that can so be
like an actual hotel, right?
Yeah, they call it a hotel, but the requirements are not that strict. It requires a bit more fire and safety regulation, something that looks like a reception area, but can be like a fully automated check-in, check-out machine kind of thing. So it's nothing insurmountable, but then we have to plan in advance, research the local municipality and see what their regulations are and research local license management companies in the area, because they have to be Minpaku or hotel license for management. And then we're looking at different kinds of properties as well. So you could potentially even buy, if you do end up getting a loan, you could potentially even buy a small, oh, sorry, but another thing I totally forgot. Another thing is, the lenders will, as the term of the loan, you're only allowed to lease the properties out long term, no Minpaku or monthly or anything of that sort.
Okay, that's a really important detail.
Yeah, they used to force you to work with their property managers for the lifetime of the loan, just to make sure you're not doing that. But right. These days, I think they've dropped that requirement. But if somehow they do find out that you're leasing out short term, they could just, you know, recall the loan or force you to switch to another loan. And that's something that you probably want to avoid.
Yeah, I don't want to do anything that's like looked unfavorably. I'd rather do everything the right way.
So bearing that in mind, let's assume you're not going to be able to get a loan if you want to go the Minpaku hotel license route, which leaves you not with a small building, which you could have gotten if you had a loan, but maybe at best a older family home kind of thing that you could convert into short-term stay.
Okay.
Another thing to consider is, though, with short-term stays can be very seasonal, can fluctuate a lot with the economy and whether, you know, if we have something like borders closure again, that everything goes to zero. So, and again, as you're probably aware, the mental bandwidth, like the amount of decision making and tweaking and, you know, looking at the rates and vacancy rates and occupancy rates and how much you're charging and how much the competition is charging, the property managers who do that will do all of that for you, but they'll constantly give you suggestions that you need to approve or disapprove, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking maybe for your first foray overseas, just go with long-term rentals. And then if and when a tenant moves out and you're in the mood, you can try to convert that maybe.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was leaning towards, was the long-term route, because I feel like it's more of a, I guess, less moving parts, right? Like you
less moving parts and more stable, reliable income as opposed to something that could fluctuate a lot, yes. I mean, potentially it could double your yield though, but maybe leave that for the second property kind of thing.
All right, big drum roll. We're up to our top three episodes. Those are the ones that you, our listeners and subscribers, dug the most these past 12 months. And at number three, a conversation with a new client who's in the market for a holiday home here in Japan. And we talk about what they may want to look out for, or watch out for rather, when searching for and reviewing property listings online.
Is it like, what is your guidance around, like, if we wanted to buy an apartment that was older than 20 years, is that risky? Or can you say a little bit more about that?
Sure. Older than 20 years is not a problem, but even before considering, you know, an age where developers might start sniffing around, we'd probably recommend to try and aim for 30 years and younger, because as okay. The buildings, these are concrete buildings, so they last obviously longer than wooden houses, but still when they approach about 40 years of age is when building expenses, renovations, repairs start, you know, becoming a bit more frequent, and then building fees as a result of that will tend to rise a lot more frequently.
Okay.
So we normally recommend to people to purchase at around 30 years and younger if they can, and then start considering potentially reselling it as it approaches 40 years. It's less of a concern for holiday home shoppers, more of a thing for investors, because when building fees rise exponentially, then yields obviously drop as a result. In your case, for holiday home purposes, it's we're talking for your own personal use, right? Not investment. Yeah.
Okay.
So in your case, it's more a case of look at what the building fees are and try to see if you'd be comfortable with them, let's say, potentially doubling in the next 5 or 6 years, right? And if you're still okay with it, if it goes from, I don't know, $200 to $400 would still be okay for you, then, you know, we'd go for it. But otherwise, try to aim for something a bit younger, maybe.
Okay. That's really good guidance.
Yeah.
Okay. And then I'm assuming we'll talk about, like, I don't know, like, we live in California, so we're very comfortable with the concept of earthquakes, and we don't live in a house that's particularly earthquake-proof, but it's a little bit of a different question with apartments. Is there age-related sort of earthquake?
1981, so again, well ahead of the age that we'd recommend anyway. We'd probably recommend not to buy anything older than, say, 94, 95, if you can.
Okay. Okay, cool.
That's for concrete. For wooden houses, the latest earthquake resistance standards are in the year 2000.
Okay, cool. Are there particular times that are better for apartment hunting than other times of the year? Like, we felt like we saw a lot of stuff come on the market because we've just been looking at listings on our own. We felt like we saw a lot of stuff come on the market, like, maybe in July. And we're wondering, like, is there a gooder time to be going?
There'll be more supply towards the end of every quarter or the beginning of the next quarter, which is why you're seeing it in July. You'll probably see more of them again in October, which is when real estate companies want to either get stuff on or off their books. So they try to sell more towards the end and beginning of the next quarter. The peak of that is around the end of the year. So probably around October, November is when you'll see the most listings come online because they also want to get them off their books for the end of the financial year.
Oh, interesting. Okay, cool. Awesome. I'm going to keep going. Tom, do you want to jump in with anything or do you want to interrupt me?
No, keep going, Sarah.
Okay. The initial deal analysis in your, I'm looking at your document now, that looks great, and I can see why you would have different sort of analyses for investment properties versus personal.
Yeah, with holiday homes, it's not really a deal analysis per se because there's no income involved or yields or anything of that sort. It's more, again, a case of how comfortable you are with what the monthly costs are.
Okay. Yeah, gotcha. So then you would just send us, like, a link to listings that are in sort of publicly available.
Correct. I mean, you would always be the best filter for that because you can look at a layout and location and a few photos and know if it ticks your boxes or not. So maybe combination of you and us researching at the same time and sending lists. With us, it's always going to be a bit more hit and miss, but we're more than happy to do that as well.
Yeah, okay. That makes sense.
Are you comfortable searching on the Japanese websites, by the way?
Very. We've been doing a lot of it. I mean, we're, you know, not that fluent in Japanese, working on it every single day, but with Google Translate, it seems very doable to us.
Yeah, it's not a, it's, yeah. So Sumo at Homes, homes.co.jp, those big ones, and Nifty.
Yeah, Tom, are those all the ones you're hitting?
Yeah, I'm very happy with Sumo. Yeah, that works.
Yep, okay. Just make sure, because those are not specifically investment-oriented websites, they're more generic, so it's a bit hard to find whether the property is tenanted or not. You don't want to buy a tenanted property because not renewing a lease for a long-term tenant is a bit of a hassle in Japan. So best avoid those and focus on the vacant ones. The vacant ones will also mostly have been recently renovated, which is also something attractive for holiday home shoppers.
We interrupt this broadcast to tell you about Tokyo Family Stays. They're a short-term rentals company in Tokyo, and they offer a home away from home experience, which is just perfect for remote working, quarantining, if that's still a thing, or if you just need somewhere quiet to get away from the world. They offer a variety of options for families, corporate relocations, or even if you're simply transitioning between homes in Tokyo. The properties are super comfortable, tastefully furnished, fully equipped with all amenities, and they accommodate up to 10 people. So really the only thing you'll need to bring with you is your toothbrush and maybe a change of clothes. They come with fast, unlimited wireless internet, dedicated workspaces, and fully equipped kitchens. And they're just a delight to stay in. Fantastic alternative to Japanese business hotels, which if you've ever stayed in one, you probably know. They're tiny, they're noisy, fine for a night or two if you're on your own. But longer term or with a family, you'll probably feel you're in a jail cell very quickly in a Japanese business hotel. So if you want to give yourself a sense of space and freedom by renting a real home, with comfortable Western beds, including all the necessities like baby bedding, children's toys, high chairs, etc., you definitely want to reach out to Tokyo Family Stays. They've been at it for over a decade. They're a fully licensed minpaku or short-term stay operator. And as a special bonus for our viewers and listeners, they're also throwing in a breakfast basket upon arrival for anyone who books and mentions the Japan Real Estate Podcast or NTI. And not only for guests, if you're a property owner, you've got an investment property that you want to tweak for higher profit, or a holiday home that you want to rent out when you're not using it via short-term stays, drop them a line today, see how they can help you maximize your property's income. And again, as a special bonus to our viewers and listeners, they're also offering a free audit of your existing short-term stay listings without any obligation whatsoever. So feel free to reach out to them at tokyofamilystays.com. Well worth a visit. And again, if you're in the market for a family home in or around the Tokyo metropolitan area, Emil's your man. Don't be shy to reach out to him as well at sales@realestate.jp. And now, back to the podcast. Okay, this is it. The final two, the most popular episodes in our list today. At number two is one of my chats with Joey Stockermans and Take Kurosawa, co-founders of Akiamart, who are also sponsors of this podcast and our clients. And they wanted to pick my brain, about a bunch of stuff, but in this segment specifically, about what people should expect from the purchase process here, how the pace is different than what many of us are used to in our countries of residence, and who should not be buying properties in Japan.
Cool. Going to switch gears a little bit and kind of focus on some of the listeners here. A lot of these guys are first-time home buyers. What's maybe one of the biggest or top two misconceptions you feel like when you first talk to a first-time home buyer?
I also want to add part to that question too. I was wondering, like, so just a little bit more to add. So one thing that I noticed when we bought our house in Japan was like, there was a lot, we had to use a lot of Japanese. So it definitely, I feel like this is not for everybody. So if you could also add like maybe what type of person should not do this.
Well, the language barrier, I don't think is an issue. In your case, you are obviously more involved because you speak the language and you know Japan. But I'd say 80 or 90% of our customers, if they have been here, they've been here on trips, right? They haven't ever lived here, studied here, definitely don't speak, read, write language. So that part of it, our involvement will be as hands-on or hands-off, depending on the customer. So familiarity with the language is not a big deal. Familiarity with the way things work in Japan is a huge deal, though. So I find that that's a bit of a rant of mine, but doesn't matter how many times I explain to people that things work differently here, they still expect them to work in many ways the same way that they do in Western countries or other countries, and they just don't. So, for example, it's very common, definitely in the US and a lot of the times in Australia where I've lived, and I'm sure in many other countries as well, it's very common that realtors are extremely hungry, right? So they'll have a deal, they're dying to kill that deal and get their commission. They'll, you know, you come to the house, you do a viewing, you like the place, they'll immediately go off to the side, call the seller, try to make it all happen within 15 minutes or an hour or a day or whatever the case may be. It just doesn't work that way here. Everything has protocol, proper channels to operate in. You might occasionally get realtors like that again, if they're dealing in multi-million dollars in Niseko or you know, big penthouses in Tokyo, whatever the case may be. But vast majority of the country will take their time to reply to any question. They will take their time and give you ample warnings about everything. It almost feels like they're trying to convince you not to make the purchase just because and again, it's the risk aversion thing. The last thing that they want is for you to come back and complain after the deal is done. So everything takes a lot more time. When they try to convince a seller to sell at a certain price, they will take their time. Multiple calls, multiple emails, slowly drip feed him the notion that maybe he should be reducing the price. And we get a lot of customers that, you know, they hire us, they
pay us. We send them the content to explain how things work here. And then they submit their first applications in 24 hours. Oh, no response. Let's go on to the next one. But no, wait, it doesn't work that way here. So that's the first thing that people need to wrap their head around. The second thing is more of a financial thing, but the reason, again, we're focusing on Akiya here, but the same goes for other properties. The reason that you're buying them so cheaply is that Japan is definitely not a capital appreciation kind of market, right? So people buy a property and expect that if they renovate it nicely and they'll be able to flip it for a profit. And that's, I wouldn't say very rarely the case, but it's definitely not for the kind of profit that you're imagining that you'll be able to sell it for. So financially and I don't know if manners-wise, protocol-wise, it's a very, very different market and people need to understand that.
Totally. And we totally hear you and feel the same. Those were kind of unexpected things for us. And, you know, me and Joey talked about it. We were trying to find more properties around us. We'd go to the real estate agent offices and see, can we see this Akiya next to us that's been abandoned for a while, that's on sale? They didn't even have the keys for it. And we're like, do these guys want to, are they trying to anti not sell us on this property? So it's really shocking, especially me being a California real estate agent. And you mentioned it, like how hungry agents are here for that. And it seems like there's a lack of that hunger in Japan for cultural reasons.
It's not just the agents, it's the sellers too, right? Especially when you're dealing with Akiya. In many cases, it's a house that's been abandoned. The seller might have preconceptions, again, dating back to pre-bubble days, that it should be selling at hundreds of thousands of dollars, even though it's worth maybe 50 or 60 now. A lot of the time, it's descendants who inherited the house and want nothing to do with it. And it's the local government trying to convince them to sell. And plenty of time, they're just not particularly motivated because financially, they're okay, you know? So if it sells, it sells. And if not, not. So the negotiation techniques that we use in the West, we had recently had a customer walk into a property and do the Western thing of, you know, oh, that, what's that over there? And oh, that doesn't look so nice. And oh, the floor is tilting. And
tire
kickers. It doesn't work here. Like the psychological warfare that you have with sellers to try and reduce the price is just not done here. The what you'll probably achieve is that agent will never want to work with you because you're a tire kicking gaijin, right? And there's ways to negotiate for sure, but that's not the way to do it here. Things are very different.
All right, you've made it this far. This is it, folks. The most popular episode on the Japan Real Estate Podcast and YouTube channel in the last year. A conversation with a first-time investor who described himself as a beginner as far as real estate property investment goes. So we discussed a whole lot of topics which would be beneficial for his education on the market here. And in this particular clip, we talk about what happens when co-owned properties, meaning normally a condo building with an owner union in place where each unit is owned by different people or different companies, what happens when these buildings become older and less profitable? That 50 years is definitely way beyond our comfort zone. We wouldn't recommend for anyone to buy anything younger than 30 at the time of purchase.
What happens to this apartment when they hit like 50 years? Do they get torn down or does the government like repossess them? Or I mean, in Singapore, sometimes it does happen. Like the government will repossess very old homes and they just compensate you a sum of money.
Not here, or at least it hasn't happened to us or anyone that I know. Normally what happens is... Far before the building reaches that age where somebody will want to buy it or repossess it, the owner, because again, they're investment properties, so the owner union is always, each and every unit owner is always thinking about the return. As building fees get higher, because when a building reaches, say, 40 years of age, that's when maintenance really starts kicking in. And yield keeps shrinking and shrinking and shrinking. So the owner union will normally vote to sell the entire building far before it even becomes an issue of forced eviction or forced reselling or anything.
Oh, they'll sell the whole building off.
Yeah, and they only need 80% agreement to pull off the sale. So usually as the building gets older, everybody kind of agrees that it's time to sell it. So there you go. Those were your top picks and favorite episodes and videos on the Japan Real Estate Podcast and YouTube channel in these last 12 months. Very interesting choices there, folks. Always insightful. So thank you for voting with your ears and downloading or streaming our content. We're thrilled that you're finding so much value in it. And one last quick reminder, if you'd like to pick the brains of our market experts, network with like-minded folks like yourselves who are interested in the real estate property market here, or just want to enjoy a fun weekend with a lot of interesting content attached, the Japan Real Estate Summit will take place on 12 and 13 April 2025, that Saturday, Sunday, at the Tokyo International Forum, right next to Tokyo Station, and also streamed online. And the only reason those discounted tickets are still available is because we're a bit too slow in putting up the official ticketing page. So take advantage of our procrastination, hop over to nippontradings.com right now and secure your early bird tickets as soon as you can. We've already got about 50 folks pre-registered, and the physical event space only holds up to about 100 of you. So we're halfway there already. Please don't say we didn't tell you so. If you wake up at the last minute, tickets may or may not be available by then. Now, before we go, we're also, as always, going to tell you and also link to our other sponsor's website. That's Hiroshi Shimizu, immigration lawyer and administrative scrivener. If you're thinking about moving here on a more permanent basis, or you're already in Japan on some sort of a temporary visa and you want to switch to a longer term or permanent one, or if you're considering setting up a local company or a branch office of a foreign company and you've got any sort of business or visa-related inquiries, or even if you just want to find out what your options are on any of these topics, feel free to contact Hiroshi Shimizu. You can find him at japanimmigrationexperts.com. And he can help you set up a company, apply for any kind of visa, or just provide you with the best advice and extremely affordable consultation related to these topics. And he's already done that for many of our listeners. So feel free to reach out to him. Again, that's japanimmigrationexperts.com, and you'll be well on your way. And that's it from us for today, folks. Hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Japan Real Estate Podcast. Do share it with your networks and please let us know what you think. So leave us a short rating or review on the iTunes Store, on Spotify, or just drop us a line in the comment section of wherever you might have found this episode. We love hearing from you. Hope to have you with us again next time. And until then, have a great day or night ahead. Yoroshiku.